accustomed purpose of my appearances here in front of this court. I'm not here looking to either extend or restore a lawyer's right to earn money practicing law. I'm not here looking to undo adverse publicity. Mr. Zaff served 26 years in the prosecutor's office in Kenosha County and a period of time in private practice, and he is retired. And so he's here for solely for the reason that this prosecution was improvidently initiated, and the decision is both unfair to him and bad policy for the state of Wisconsin, and jeopardizes, we believe, criminal prosecutions from this day forward if the referee's report in this case is endorsed. As you know, we're here in a case involving the delivery in compliance with the Brady Rule of delivery of exculpatory evidence, or allegedly exculpatory evidence. And in this case, as in the Reek case, and I digress for a minute, you'll remember perhaps that in 2013, the OLR came to this court in a disciplinary matter involving a Racine assistant district attorney, saying expand Brady to require district attorneys to turn over information that's attenuated and perhaps doesn't have a bearing on the outcome of the case. And this court, and essentially, you know, make this a more collaborative, forthcoming requirement. This court said no, quite rightly. The OLR urged the court to have Wisconsin become part of a minority of states and jurisdictions where more than the Brady Rule was enforced against prosecutors. And now they're back. They're back making essentially the same suggestion to this court. This case involved a murder trial. And the facts are that on April 14th, 2014, two gentlemen, Marchese Tibbs and Jamal Brantley, shot and killed a 20-year-old young man in Kenosha in the course of a drug deal. This was a drug deal arranged by a man named Brandon Horak, who was staying with them at a residence at 1208 59th Street in Kenosha. Upon arrival at the scene in a car, Mr. Edwards was accompanied by his cousin, Jacob Lang. Mr. Brantley went to the driver's side of the vehicle. When the pot was produced, grabbed the pot, hit Mr. Edwards in the head, and shot him in the chest with a .32 caliber gun. Mr. Edwards managed to drive off a distance, jumped a curb, hit a house, and died. The two defendants left the scene and walked back to their residence at 1208 59th Street. When the police arrived at the scene where Mr. Edwards died, his cousin, Mr. Lang, told them what had happened, took them back to the scene of the shooting. They followed footprints in the snow to 1208 59th Street and arrested Mr. Tibbs and Mr. Brantley. Both Brantley and Tibbs admitted their identity. Both admitted that they were staying there at 1208 59th Street. The murder weapon and the pot were found in a ceiling tile in a bedroom of that house. The ballistics evidence linked that to the, established that as the murder weapon, and DNA on the murder weapon was found to have been Brantley's. Both Mr. Tibbs and Mr. Horak, who was also present, implicated Mr. Brantley as the gunman.
And counsel, what was the caliber of that gun?
The murder weapon was a .32 caliber gun. Also found at that scene of the scene of the crime were a number of .22 caliber bullets, unexpended bullets, the search, the arrest, and so on was carried out by a host of Kenosha Police Department personnel, one of whom was, for lack of a better means of characterizing him, unstable. A man named Bars, Kyle Bars. Kyle Bars was given responsibility to take Mr. Tibbs to the police station for booking and did so. In the course of that trip, he obtained from Mr. Tibbs an Illinois ID card. And instead of putting it into evidence, he put it in his pocket, probably inadvertently, forgot it was there, took it home with him. When he was called back to duty on the during the day of April 15th, the following day, to assist in a follow-up search of the premises, he brought the ID with him. He, in the course of his work, found a blue backpack in one of the bedrooms and took the contents out and put it on a TV or a dresser and included with that the ID that he had taken from Tibbs. Why he did this is not known. Perhaps out of some sort of sense of embarrassment about having failed to turn it in as he should have the night before. He reveals what he has done, what he found, the backpack and the contents, to Officer Traxler, Detective Traxler, who was in charge of the search. And Detective Traxler said, put that stuff back in the backpack. He does that. Included in the material which he says he found in the backpack was a .22 caliber bullet. Later, much later, during the trial of Brantley, he reveals that he had brought that .22 caliber bullet along with the ID to the scene and introduced that to the backpack, both of which were not accurate. And at this time, on April 15, 2014, Bars and only Bars knows he's done that. The defendants are charged with homicide and a host of different crimes. Tibbs is also charged with a robbery that took place a few days before the murder. And his case goes to trial in October of 2014. And somewhere near the end of that trial, Bars goes to his supervising officer, a man named Kennessy, and says, I made some errors with respect to evidence in the Brantley and Tibbs case, and tells him that he inadvertently handled the ID as I've just described, suggesting and in fact saying to Kennessy, I made a mistake. Kennessy tells him to prepare a report. He does so. Kennessy thinks it's inadequate. He ends up preparing three reports, the last of which is dated November 11th, 2014. That's a report sort of pivotal in this case because in it he makes known what he did with the ID. He says nothing in that report about the bullet, but sometime thereafter asks Mr. Kennessy, Detective Kennessy, what if the bullet is the issue? Whereupon Kennessy says, are you saying you planted a bullet, that the bullet was put in the backpack? And Bars very flatly says, no, I'm not. But I've been having some false memories and dreams about the bullet. And Kennessy, well, quite rightly doesn't know what to make of that, asks him, are you saying you planted that? And he says, no. Bob Zapp knows nothing about any of this conduct from October until January 9, 2015, a few weeks before Tibbs is about to enter a plea, and Brantley is scheduled to go to trial. And on January 9th, Kennessy, along with two officers, meet with Mr. Zaff and tell him what Kennessy knows, that is, that there was some mishandling of evidence, and that's how they characterize it. They don't say planting. They don't say it was deliberate. They say it was, it gives a very distinct impression it was a mistake and it involved the ID. And Kennessy reveals what I just described concerning the bullet, that there was also a bullet in the backpack, that Bars asked him, what if the bullet is the issue, and that he asked him flatly whether it was put in there by him or not, and it was denied, and says, but I've been having dreams and false memories. Upon hearing this, Mr. Zaff is not concerned about either the ID or the bullet, because the ID is not an issue in the case. Both of them were identified by their own description accurately, and both acknowledged that they resided at that premise. And the murder weapon was not a .22 caliber gun. It was a .32. Nonetheless, Mr. Zaff said, consistent with a policy that he's observed throughout his tenure as a prosecutor, I need a report. I want a report of what you've just told me, because I have to provide that to the defense attorneys. And incidentally, in this case, both the OLR and the referee seem to think there's some inconsistency between the contention that this wasn't Brady evidence, this wasn't evidence as was explained in the Bagley case, likely to change the outcome of the matter, but that he submitted it anyhow. He did exactly what I think you would ask of a prosecutor under these circumstances. He reviewed what had happened, notwithstanding that he came to the conclusion, a correct conclusion, that this was not Brady evidence. He planned to turn it over anyhow. He asked for a report. The report, at that time, he was not told that there was a report in the possession of Officer Kennessy from Officer Bars. And so he expected to get that report sometime in the time thereafter and send it off to the defense attorneys. He met with the police chief on January 19th. And the police chief, having been made aware of the conduct of Officer Bars, apologized. I'm sorry my officer, goofed up as he did, and told Mr. Zaff that an internal affairs investigation had been initiated and that Bars had resigned, that Bars had delivered a letter saying simply, I resign. He told Mr. Zaff, I gave Bars an opportunity to explain himself, to tell me how and why this happened, and he declined. He simply said he resigned. So Mr. Zaff intuited and surmised with good justification that the resignation had to do with the mishandling of the evidence. But he didn't have firsthand information of that, and he never got any documentation concerning the resignation, either an explanation or the resignation letter itself. He got it secondhand from the police chief, and although reliable, it was still secondhand. Eventually, on the 21st of January, Officer Kennedy has delivered to Mr. Zaff this report dated November 11, 2014. It's an important exhibit, as I said earlier, and although it's not a model of clarity, it says, I got the ID from Tibbs and I put it into the backpack the next day. It says nothing about the bullet, that's not alarming or concerning to Mr. Zaff because it's consistent with what he had been told. That is that Bars denied planting or introducing the bullet to the backpack, said only that was having strange dreams and so on, and so absence of a reference to the bullet was consistent with what Mr. Zaff had understood. And at this point, he still thinks this was a mistake on the part of this officer. It's reflected in this report, and I'm going to send it to the defense counsel. Tibbs hired attorney Terry Rose in Kenosha, and Brantley hired a lawyer from Racine named Christopher Glinsky. They both filed discovery requests, and pursuant to Mr. Zaff's policy, longstanding, open file policy, they were given access to the hard copy of the DA's entire file early on in the representation. And it's one of the ironies of this case that Mr. Zaff was disciplined by means of a public reprimand for a failure to turn over evidence in a murder case in 1985. To my way of thinking, that was questionable his acquiescence to that, which he did, he stipulated to that, was kind of a dubious decision, because what he failed to turn over, there was a last-minute addition to the statement of a hostile witness that was incriminating about disposing of the murder weapon to the victim witness assistant. That was made known to Mr. Zaff just on the eve of trial, and he didn't make that known to the defense. The Court of Appeals reversed the convictions. The BAPR filed charges against Mr. Zaff, and this court decided that this was not Brady evidence, that it was not exculpatory information. It was incriminating information. It had to do with one of the defendants talking about disposing of the murder weapon. So although he failed to disclose it, the convictions were reinstated. In any case, he stipulated to the discipline, but he learned from it. He adopted two policies that were ironclad, and it was testified to by four different witnesses, two live and two by affidavit and letter, that he instituted two policies. One was an open file policy. In a criminal case, the defense lawyer can come in and see the entire file and copy parts of it free of charge here in our office, both of which were unique to not necessarily the only office where that was done, but it was not required, and it was not a practice observed elsewhere in the state of Wisconsin. Secondly, he told his officers and his assistants, nothing exists here unless it's put in writing. So if you get something from someone, from a police officer or otherwise, I want you to get it in writing. And he wanted to get it in writing for the purposes that he had in this case, which was to make it known to the defense lawyers, complying with at least an arguable obligation concerning Brady evidence. These things were misunderstood by the judge, by the referee in this case. The referee thought that when he said, when one of the witnesses said that Mr. Zaff said nothing exists unless it's put in writing, that somehow was a device that was employed to deny things that weren't in writing, which is hardly the case. In any case, Mr. Zaff sends the report that he receives, the only report he ever receives in this case, from Officer Kennessy to Mr. Glinski, Mr. Rose, and files copies of his cover letter and the report with both of the trial courts before whom the matters were pending. Everybody gets it except Terry Rose says, dog ate my homework. I didn't get this from Mr. Zaff. And it kind of intimates that that was something deliberate on Mr. Zaff's part. Hardly credited him with any sort of Machiavellian skills, because he did file copies with another defense lawyer and with both of the courts, which is reflected on CCAP in both cases.
Counsel, before time runs out, I'd like to explore what the circuit court judge ruled with respect to the issue of whether there was a Brady violation or any other kind of discovery violation. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. The Brantley case is pending in front of Judge Bruce Schrader, experienced trial judge in Kenosha. And in the course of the case, the defense lawyer takes some testimony from one of the officers, the photographer at the scene, that is inaccurate by Mr. Zaff's understanding. And he doesn't know what to make of it, but eventually surmises that Glinski didn't understand this report that I sent, didn't understand that the ID was not in the backpack originally, that it was brought to the scene and placed in the backpack. And so he makes known, it's my understanding that this was introduced, it was mishandled in the way that it was, and that Officer Bars has resigned as a result of it. Judge Schrader says, well, let's explore that. As Mr. Zaff facilitates an interview with Bars over the telephone, and motions are brought by Glinski arguing gross government misconduct. And Judge Schrader, knowing all that there is to know about these circumstances, says, this is not Brady evidence. This was not relevant to the case. ID was not an issue. And although everybody knew this was terrible conduct, and Mr. Zaff referred Bars to the Milwaukee DA, and they prosecuted him for misconduct in office. So we're not defending that conduct, but Judge Schrader ruled this is not Brady evidence. The caliber of the bullet is wrong, and the ID was not an issue, so proceed. But what Judge Schrader did say was, I'll let you call Officer Bars, present his testimony to the jury, and argue to your heart's content governmental misconduct and whatever else one might argue based on this revelation. And I guess what one could argue is, hey, this cop acted dishonestly. Maybe this whole prosecution, all the police officers, the forensics people, the eyewitness cousin Lang, the co-defendant Horak and Tibbs, who testified against Brantley, maybe they're all lying. Maybe this is all just completely cocked up. But Judge Schrader recognized this is too attenuated a fact to constitute Brady evidence, but I'm still going to let you argue it. And Klinsky did. Put on Bars, argued police misconduct to the jury, and Mr. Brantley was convicted.
The referee's reports says, ultimately, Attorney Klinsky testified that Judge Bruce Schrader, the trial judge in this case, ruled that the entire planting of evidence issue by Officer Bars was not relevant, was not exculpatory evidence under Brady, and was not reflective of outrageous government conduct. Do you agree that that's an accurate representation of what the judge ruled?
Yes, yes. And I think the judge was absolutely correct, self-evidently correct, because of the facts that were being misrepresented by Officer Bars.
Did Mr. Brantley appeal his conviction?
I believe that Mr. Brantley has appealed. He also brought motions after in front of Judge Schrader, which, to my knowledge, although it's not part of this record, were denied upon the same reasoning as he gave on the motions during the trial. Not relevant, not Brady. And I think one could argue it was turned over. Notwithstanding the attenuated nature of these facts, Mr. Zaff did exactly what one would do, even if it was Brady evidence. Give me a report. I need to give it to the defense lawyer. Got the report. Sent it to the defense lawyer.
Do you happen to know if the Brady issue constitutes any part of the appeal?
I think it does, but I don't have first-hand information about that,
okay.
as Mr. Zaff said.
If it does, isn't it a little bit premature to decide the Brady issue in an OLR proceeding?
Well, I think that deciding the Brady issue in an OLR proceeding is 100% wrong without regard to how it comes out. You're right. This prosecution is totally at odds with the ruling by Judge Schrader in the trial court that this is not Brady evidence. And holds the promise of being inconsistent down the road when the Court of Appeals rules. But the reason this is unfair is that if we're going to change the rules concerning the conduct of district attorneys, we ought not do it in a disciplinary case. If we want to say you need to do more than what Brady requires of you, as the OLR was arguing in the Rick case, let's do it by rule. Let's not ambush a district attorney who in a nuanced, borderline case steps across a different line, or a line that doesn't presently exist.
Is there any argument that Mr. Zaff violated the basic discovery statute, separate and apart from the question of whether there was a Brady violation?
I don't think so. None was alleged, and although I don't profess to be an expert on criminal discovery, the open file policy was in effect throughout these cases. So Mr. Rose and Mr. Glinsky were free to look at CCAP, see what had been done, come in and look at the entire hard copy file of the district attorney's office at any time, right up until the time of trial. So we know it's not Brady evidence for two reasons. Number one, it didn't change the outcome of the Brantley trial when it was employed by Attorney Glinsky to no effect. And Mr. Tibbs brought a motion to withdraw his guilty plea that he had entered before the Brantley trial, and Mr. Zaff said, fine, we'll stipulate to it, withdraw it. Attorney Rose said, well, I don't know enough about the underlying facts here, so he conducted a series of kind of grandstanding, media-intense hearings in Kenosha in the course of the summer, throughout the summer of 2015, and took testimony from Mr. Zaff, the police chief, all the officers involved, and learned everything he could about the facts of the conduct of Officer Bars, and said, oh, no thank you. I don't want to withdraw my guilty plea. So if there's a question about whether or not it's Brady evidence, in the one case, it was declined a defense attorney declined to make use of it, and in the second case, it was used to no effect.
Thank you.
See my red light on.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Chief Justice, members of the court, distinguished counsel, my name is Greg Herman. I'm retained counsel for OLR in this matter. This matter involves one of the most serious type of misconduct by a police department that one could imagine.
The police conduct is not an issue here, right? Police conduct is not at issue here. The issue is Mr. Zapp's conduct.
It
yes?
ties into Mr. Zapp's conduct, Your Honor, because Mr. Zaff was informed on two separate occasions prior to trial of the police misconduct. He was specifically told in two separate meetings with the chief of police of Kenosha that a police officer on the Kenosha Police Department had planted evidence.
Was that phrase used?
I'm sorry?
Was that phrase used?
Yes. He was told there was evidence planted. He further told the detective during the meeting, and this is uncontroverted, that we'll have to tell the defense about this. They then investigated by taking the Wisconsin statutes to investigate whether or not they needed to report this to another district attorney's office for prosecution. And Mr. Zaff and the chief of the Kenosha Police Department decided that this needed to be reported to the defense and that this needed to be referred for prosecution. A procedure was started to terminate Officer Bars.
In both of those actions occurred, correct? The defense was alerted to what had occurred, and this was referred for prosecution of the officer.
Yes. Before the termination proceeding was completed, Officer Bars resigned as a result of his conduct in the search warrant.
How do you know it was as a result of?
It's part of the record in this matter that Mr. Zaff, I believe, admitted, as I recall, there's a lengthy stipulation of facts that Officer Bars' resignation was directly related to his conduct at the search warrant.
Okay.
I don't believe that's in dispute, Your Honor.
And what was that? That's correct. But what was that information based on? What was that stipulation based on?
It was based upon what Mr. Zaff was informed in the two meetings with the Kenosha Police Department.
Okay. And so that was not personal knowledge of
that he was directly told it by the Kenosha Police Department. He knew it. He was told in the two separate meetings
Counsel, we generally make a distinction between what one personally knows and what is hearsay, don't we?
It's always an issue, Your Honor, in terms of legal proceedings. But when you're directly told by the chief of police that an officer has committed misconduct, you know it. And
that's pretty much, Counsel, that's pretty much the definition of hearsay, isn't it?
Everything in that sense is hearsay in one sense or another in this world, in that unless he was present at the search warrant and actually saw Officer Bars do it. But he knew it.
Or if Officer Bars had told him, that would be personal knowledge.
He did not, to our knowledge, he did not directly hear it from Officer Bars,
correct,
but he did hear it from the chief of police.
Is it OLR's position that hearsay constitutes personal knowledge?
No. So, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Okay. I'll take that answer.
Okay. It's our position that when he told the judge that I do not have personal knowledge or documentation, that he was misleading the court.
Which part of that was misleading?
Well, we believe the personal knowledge because he did know. If you want to say that
I thought you just said the OLR does not take the position that hearsay is personal knowledge.
That's correct. However, the documentation which he had, Mr. Zaff's trying to have it both ways. He's saying on the one hand, I didn't have documentation.
Documentation of what?
Of Officer Barr's conduct planting the evidence.
I'm sorry, that's not what he said. He said he did not have documentation that the officer resigned because of the misconduct, correct?
He said, if I get the exact quote.
I'll give it to you. He told the trial court that he did not have personal knowledge of any documentation regarding Officer Barr's resignation for misconduct. And then you say, clearly, this was not true.
Correct. He says, right. Although I don't have personal knowledge and I don't have anything in documentation that is a result of the misunderstanding on how those items got into the backpack or into evidence, Officer Barr's resigned from the police department. I don't know anything about discipline. And the referee specifically found that those statements were misleading to the court and done with an intention to mislead the court into not understanding what Mr. Zaff knew.
I want to focus on what you are saying in the prosecution. Page 13 of your brief. On the other hand, he told the trial court that he did not have any documentation regarding Officer Barr's resignation for misconduct. That's 100% true. He did not.
Depends how you define personal knowledge, Your Honor.
No, it depends on what's in the document. The document does not say he resigned for misconduct. The document that he had was the police report that acknowledged his misconduct. It said nothing about whether he was going to resign as a consequence of that. Can you point me to the documentation that says he resigned because of his misconduct?
There is no such documentation.
Then how is it that you are saying that he misled the court by telling it that he did not have any documentation regarding Officer Barr's resignation for misconduct?
Because
he didn't.
He had the police reports.
I understand that, but that's not documentation of his resignation for misconduct.
But he knew that.
The question is documentation, right?
And personal knowledge.
Okay, let's take him one at a time. You've already acknowledged to me the OLR does not take the position that hearsay is personal knowledge. So we can set that aside. Your second point is that he had documentation that he resigned because of misconduct, and that's simply not true.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, but I believe you're looking at this too narrowly. I think you have to look at this in a larger picture, that Mr. Zaff knew what Officer Barr's had done, and he knew the results of it.
Your charge in this case,
yes,
was that he misrepresented to the court.
Yes.
And misrepresentation is an intentional thing, yes?
Yes.
And you are telling this court that he misrepresented to the trial court that he did not have documentation that Officer Barr's resigned as a result of misconduct.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, you're looking at it too narrowly.
I'm looking at what you wrote in your brief.
Your Honor, I'm saying in its entirety, his statements to the court were designed to mislead the court about what he knew. What he said... And again, Your Honor, I suggest you look at it in its entirety. He first stated that there were rumors. This is more than just rumors. And then he said, although I don't have personal knowledge, I don't have anything in documentation that is a result of the misunderstanding. There was no misunderstanding. There's no misunderstanding. He knew exactly what Officer Barr's did. That is a result of the misunderstanding on how those items got into the backpack or into evidence, Officer Barr's resigned from the police department. He knew exactly why Officer Barr's resigned.
Counsel, what you just read is what he told the circuit court.
Yes.
Okay. So he said he's providing the information that his understanding was that he resigned as a result of misconduct. Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. So how is it that he's misleading the court in your eyes? He just said in that statement that it was his understanding, although he did not have personal knowledge, that he was resigning because of misconduct. How is that a misrepresentation?
Because it's telling the court, I don't know what happened, there's just a rumor, and somehow this ended up in the backpack, and there was some sort of misunderstanding, and I don't understand the whole thing.
Where does he use the word rumor?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Where does he use the word rumor?
He said earlier to the trial court that there was a rumor of misconduct.
Okay. And what he said in the statement that you use as the basis of your charge, he says, what I would understand subsequently, although I don't have personal knowledge and I don't have anything in documentation, that as a result of the misunderstanding or how those items got into the backpack or into evidence, Officer Bars resigned from the police department. I don't know anything about discipline. I don't know anything about prior history, but Officer Bars resigned as a result of it, in part, I would say, as a result of his mishandling of evidence at the crime scene or the shooting at the residence. He's telling the court that his understanding is that the officer resigned as a result of the misconduct. How can that possibly mislead the court about whether he resigned as a result of misconduct?
That is, again, if you look at a particular part of it and look at each part individually, you may be right, Your Honor. Looking at it in terms of the totality of the statements he made, he is at minimum underestimating in terms of what happened and what he knew, and more particularly
underestimating is not a misrepresentation.
In its entirety, Your Honor, our contention is that his statement here was designed to mislead the trial court into the severity of what Officer Bars did. Please remember, this is at the end of a multi-day jury trial where the evidence inadvertently comes up. And to the surprise of both the judge and the defense attorney, and Mr. Zaff, at the end of the trial, with the jury still impaneled, says, well, there's this rumor that something went on here and there was some misunderstanding and I don't have personal knowledge and I don't have any documentation. It's our contention that you may be hearsay, but it's still something he knows.
To the extent that it's personal knowledge, he told the court, right? He said, my understanding is that he resigned as a result of misconduct. Yeah? Why is it the problem that he says, I don't have personal knowledge? He conveyed the information.
I think personal knowledge goes broader than what you're suggesting, Your Honor. Knowledge would include hearsay.
Correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding of the prosecution of this case is that you're concerned about a misrepresentation to the court. Yeah?
That's the third count.
I'm sorry?
That's the third count.
Yeah.
There were three counts. That was the third count.
That's one of the ones that we're considering, right?
That's one of the counts, yes.
Okay. So if the concern is a misrepresentation to the court, and in the charging document itself it says that he gave the information to the court, how can you get a misrepresentation out of that?
Because the information, what he stated to the court, as found by the referee, was not entirely accurate, and as found by the referee, was designed to be misleading to the court. Looking at the statement in its entirety, it did not come out and directly state to the court, we had an officer who committed a felony in the investigation of this matter, who is being prosecuted for that felony, who is resigned because a discharge action was started against him, and some of the evidence introduced in this trial was obtained by the commission of a felony by a police officer in its investigation.
Mr. Herman, I think what the issue seems to be, at least in my mind, is when Mr. Zaff, the allegation that he somehow knew this before, the evidence shows that he did. So the morning of the trial is the first time anyone talks to the officer, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The morning of the trial, that day that the evidence had just come out inadvertently, and then Mr. Zaff goes to the judge, and then they get the officer on the phone, right?
Yeah, it's the last day of the trial.
But that's the first time that anyone hears from the officer that he did this deliberately, that he had the bullet involved. At that point, he's not charged with a felony, right? I mean, none of that. I feel like you're conflating all of the facts at the end and putting it on Mr. Zaff as something he should have known at the point in time at which he made the disclosure.
At that time, he knew two things.
Yes.
Okay? He knew that this was serious enough that it should be reported to defense attorneys. And second, he knew it was serious enough that it constituted a felony.
Well, I don't agree with that second point from the record. Where in the record does it show that Mr. Zapp thought that at the point in time of that last day of trial, he had any information that this was done deliberately? At that point, all he had was a report that said that this was a mishandling of an ID. It didn't even talk about the bullet. And where would Mr. Zapp have known anything more than that, known it?
The chief of police met with him twice and told him that Barrs planted evidence at the scene.
He told him that he planted evidence at the scene? I don't know. Where in the record is that, Mr. Herman?
The evidence is that the chief's statements to Zapp in the two meetings was regarding the police officer planting evidence.
But at that point, I don't even think they knew he planted evidence. They thought he mishandled evidence.
No.
Well, where is that? Show me. I would like to see that with my own eyes of where we know that this officer told Mr. Zapp that Officer Barrs planted evidence. Perfectly. I mean, that planted is a pretty heavy-duty word, right? It means
Yes. Some
kind of intentional conduct.
Yes.
Okay,
which is
so
exactly.
Where did Mr. Zapp, I want to know, because he's the one we care about here in terms of this disciplinary proceeding. When did Mr. Zapp become aware of that? You're saying it was before the conversation with the officer the last day of trial when they
No.
got him on the phone?
It was prior to that.
When?
When he met with the chief of police, those two dates in January.
And where does it say that in the record? That the chief of police told him he planted the evidence. That's not one of the stipulated facts as to the date.
Without having the time to read through the entire transcript.
Okay, and I don't want to put you on the spot, other than I think that these facts really matter as to when Mr. Zapp knew them.
And our contention is that he knew them, and I can submit this to you later if you'd like, I can look through the transcript, is during the discussion with the chief of police.
And your contention here to us is that during that discussion, Mr. Zapp was told by the chief of police that his officer planted evidence.
That's our understanding, Your Honor. That's my understanding, Your Honor, yes. If I'm wrong, I'll withdraw that, but I will be pleased to. It's my understanding that at that time he had knowledge in terms of what happened, and I submit to you the report of the referee, of Judge Glynn, who specifically found that Mr. Zapp did have personal knowledge at the time, that Officer Barrs had planted the evidence.
The stipulations, Counsel, the stipulation 28 says, Zapp stipulated that the defense was not informed that Barrs had planted the .22 caliber bullet in the blue backpack until the morning of February 27, 2015. That's the same date as the rest of the conversation with the trial court. Is that correct?
The rest of the conversation with whom, Your Honor?
The conversation with the trial courts?
Yes.
The one that forms the basis for the misconduct charge, yeah?
That's correct. The
right,
only
so,
evidence that the defense had was the November 11th report.
All right. So so if I understand correctly, the idea of planting looms large in your mind, and that your concern is Mr. Zapp did not say that the evidence had been planted.
Correct. That there'd been police,
but
that
your stipulation with Mr. Zapp is that he did say that it was planted at that hearing with the court.
That the defense was not informed that Barrs had planted it until February 27, 2015.
Right. In that same hearing, that forms the basis for your charges here. So he did tell the defense and the court that the evidence had been planted.
He told them it was a problem.
I'm sorry, your stipulation was that he said that he told the court that it was planted. That's what your stipulation
said. The stipulation said they were not informed until that morning.
Right.
And then
that it was planted. So obviously on that day, they were informed that it was planted.
Eventually they were informed on that day.
On February 27th, the same day as of the hearing that constitutes the basis for OLR's charge.
My understanding is that Officer Barrs testified on that day and did testify that he planted, it's my understanding that he did testify that he planted the information.
So the court on February 27th heard that the evidence had been planted.
I believe it was the same day, Your Honor.
That's what the stipulation says.
But that wasn't what Mr. Zapp told the court initially.
Okay.
And
so
our view is, I said it.
So the court's heard it's been planted. And then Mr. Zapp tells his information. And his information is, this is what I heard. And he conveyed that to the court. What more do you want from him? What statement should he have made? Tell me what the statement should have been.
He should have told, first of all, Your Honor, this should have been told to defense attorneys before the last day of trial.
Maybe, but that's not the issue here.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The issue here is misrepresentation.
Yes, but I'm dealing with the first count. It should have been, I'll get to the third count in a second. But on the first count, they should have been told before the first day of trial, because felony police misconduct in the investigation of a case is not something that is mild, is not something that's unimportant, is not something that's immaterial. In terms of this, what he should have told the trial court is that there was a police officer who has resigned as a result of the misconduct committed during a search warrant in this case.
He doesn't know that. He doesn't know that.
I believe he did, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, let me put it this way. That's a factual assertion. And we all know, I think, as lawyers, how important it is to be careful about factual assertions,
yes,
especially when they have, when they carry potentially defamation of character consequences. For him, for Mr. Zapp, to say of an officer that he resigned because of carries some potential implications for him, doesn't it?
Yes.
Isn't it much more, shouldn't he be careful about what he says and the way he characterizes it? How can you frame this as an ethical violation because he didn't say, I personally know that the officer resigned because of his misconduct, when all he has is hearsay?
With apologies to the court for repeating myself, it's reading his statement in its entirety leads both, not just myself, but the referee also to believe that his intention in making that statement was made to mislead the court. That's what the referee specifically found, and that's what we believe, is that the entirety of the statement was not done to inform the court and inform the defense attorneys of specifically what occurred.
Let me read count three to you of your complaint. By falsely informing the trial court on February 27, after the close of evidence, that he did not have personal knowledge and did not have anything in documentation regarding Barr's resignation from KPD for official misconduct and planting evidence at the scene of a homicide investigation, he violated the rule. By falsely informing.
Can I explain, Your Honor? You have to tie this into count one. Count one is that he didn't provide exculpatory information. His defense to count one at trial was, I provided the 11-11 report. He can't have it both ways, Your Honor.
What's both ways?
Both ways is saying, I provided sufficient documentation to the defense attorney to fulfill my obligation under Brady, and then tell the trial court, I don't have any documentation.
I'm sorry, there's no conflict between those whatsoever, counsel. None.
Oh, I disagree, None. Your Honor.
I don't understand how you find a conflict between those two things. He handed over the documentation that he had, and then when questioned about what documentation he had, specifically about whether he had documentation that he resigned because of his misconduct, he said no. And the reason he said no is because he had no such documentation.
But
how are those inconsistent?
Because he said his defense to count one in not providing exculpatory evidence is, I provided documentation.
He did.
I provided a report.
He did. He provided a report that showed that the officer had improperly handled evidence. That has nothing to do with whether the officer resigned because of that. There is no document that has been shown to this court that indicates that Officer Barrs resigned because of his misconduct. There is none.
But you understand, but there is documentation.
Don't gloss over that so quickly, because that forms the basis of your charge against Mr. Zapp, that when he said there was no documentation that he resigned because of the misconduct, that he misrepresented a fact to the court.
Forgive me, Your Honor. You're looking at it too narrowly.
I'm looking at what you put in the charge.
Our contention is his statement to the court in its entirety is misleading.
Counsel, I've got to be honest with you. Obviously, I'm not speaking for the court in this.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm obviously not speaking for the court in this. But I find absolutely no merit in this complaint, and I'm shocked that it's here. This is a basic, OLR has made a basic error of logic in this. When you say that Mr. Zapp can't have it both ways, that's a logical error that you're making. And you're asking to have him suspended for a year based on OLR's logical error.
First of all, we're asking a 90-day suspension. The referee recommended a year. But that's a small point. More importantly, Your Honor, is our central contention here is much different than what you're saying, and it's much more severe. This is a highly unusual case in which there is very important, very severe police misconduct. That police misconduct, which I can't imagine anything more horrific than a police officer planting evidence at the scene of a crime with the intention.
And the officer has been charged and, I believe, convicted of that. Yes?
I'm sorry.
The officer has been charged for that. Yes?
Yes.
And convicted, right?
Yes. Okay. And he informed the other officer at Kenosha Police Department, who informed the chief of police, who in turn informed Mr. Zapp. Mr. Zapp knew of it. It is our contention, and the referee agreed, that information of police misconduct is material, relevant, and exculpatory, and must be told to the defense.
And why is it, counsel, that we should accept the referee's decision on this? There's already a circuit court judge who's decided that this is not exculpatory and that it's not a Brady violation. And that question is working its way up through the appellate system right now. Why should we preempt that process?
I'm not sure if it's being appealed on that basis or not, or the status of the appeal.
Let's say it's not.
I'm sorry?
Let's say it's not. Why is it that we would want to have a referee in the OLR system second-guessing a circuit court judge who had the case in front of him and made a decision that there was not a Brady violation and not exculpatory evidence?
The judge's decision was based purely upon the bullet and the ID. The bullet and the ID didn't prove anything regarding the defendant's guilt. What is important for our legal system, and I submit for our disciplinary system, is when there is police misconduct of this severity, that it is not the job of the prosecutor to decide what, how much, or when to tell the defense attorney, and to provide it only in a vague, inexact, indefinite report put in the middle of other reports and labeled other miscellaneous material enclosed. One of the defense attorneys claimed he never got it. The other said, I got it, it didn't mean anything, and I challenge you to read that exhibit, that 1111 report, and say that if you knew nothing about any of this, nothing of what happened to the by Officer Bars or what happened there, that you could read that report and know what happened. And our contention is that the defense has a right to know if there is severe police misconduct that occurs at the scene of a crime. This isn't a matter of police mislabeling evidence or making a typographical error in a report or losing something. This is intentional police misconduct. And the defense attorneys have a right and an obligation to investigate it. Both defense attorneys said that had they known about it, they would have wanted to investigate and ascertain whether there was other misconduct, and this was not addressed by the circuit court judge.
So this was addressed in court. Officer Bars was made available. He was questioned. He was cross-examined. Mr. Zapp told the circuit court that this had occurred. He said that it was his understanding that Mr. Barrs resigned as a result of the misconduct. All of this came out.
It came out after the one defendant had already pled guilty.
And he was offered an opportunity to take back that plea,
and
he didn't.
No. He decided he was not offered that opportunity. He decided not to bring a motion to withdraw his plea for whatever reason. Defendants sometimes make decisions for a lot of varied reasons, but he didn't bring that motion. The other defendant had a hearing,
but he could have, yes? Let's not keep
he
this.
He could have brought the motion. We don't know what would have happened. But all of this came out after the guilty plea and on the last day of trial of the other defendant.
Counsel, if you could help me with this. OLR has a burden to establish with regard to count three that a burden by clear, satisfactory, I think, and convincing evidence that Attorney Zapp knowingly made a false statement to the court. The focus of our attention thus far has been the allegation by OLR that D.A. Zapp said to what D.A. Zapp said to the circuit court was false. And what is quoted is several times thus far in the argument here. It starts, what I would understand subsequently, although I don't have personal knowledge, etc. That quote talks about a misunderstanding. It talks about a resignation as a result of handling or mishandling. So there's two misses in there. Misunderstanding. Potential mishandling or handling. I don't see anything there about misconduct. Now, if the chief of police said to Zapp, twice you say, the resignation was because of misconduct by the officer, where is that? Because this seems to me, if he really knew it, this seems to be minimizing that information because, oh, it's a misunderstanding. Oh, it deals with handling or mishandling. Not a gross felony, you know, give me a break. But where have you shown that in the record that the DA knew that the resignation was as a result of misconduct or, as you assert, felonious misconduct? Where have you shown that?
He knew that.
Where have you shown it in the record is the question.
He knew that the record shows, both in the testimony of the detective and, for that matter, Mr. Zapp, that during his meetings with the chief, he was told about the misconduct of Attorney Barrs and that a disciplinary action would be started against him. He subsequently learned that Officer Barrs had resigned. It is a reasonable inference that Officer Barrs resigned as a result of the disciplinary proceeding started against him.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
As of the morning when Attorney Zapp recognized that Attorney Glinsky didn't understand the report that had been sent to him. As of that time, the word planting hasn't been used. The only thing he understands is that there was a mistake made, that evidence was mishandled. He had exactly what Attorney Glinsky had, and he had exactly what Attorney Rose would have had if he could keep track of his mail.
Our discipline proceedings commenced for a benign mishandling of evidence? I don't know.
Well, probably not.
No.
I don't know. But I will say, categorically, Police Chief Morrissey did not say anything to Attorney Zapp during that meeting. He was called as a witness by Mr. Herman on behalf of the OLR and asked questions at page 12 of the transcript concerning the meeting on the 19th. Was this discussion about both the ID and the bullet, or just the ID? Answer, I don't know that we really didn't have a discussion of the facts of the case at all, because it was my understanding on January 9th, detectives and Captain Larson met with the DA to inform him of this. So it wasn't at that meeting. We didn't sit down and go through and go piece by piece through this case. Question. Mr. Zaff knew that Officer Bars had admitted planting the ID by the time you met with him, correct? Answer. I don't know that I can say what Mr. Zaff knew or didn't know. It was my belief that he had been informed. You discussed it at the meeting with him, correct? Again, we didn't have a formal discussion on the whole Bars incident. We discussed that Kyle resigned. And he goes on to say that it was Attorney Zaff who said, I still haven't got a report. I need a report. And when he got that report, he sent it along. One of the very troubling things in this case, and I think you ought to think of it as the with respect to the policy that it incorporates, is that the OLR said, well, he got and sent the only report that he ever received concerning Mr. Bars' conduct. It wasn't a model of clarity, but it was the means by which he understood what he knew about the incident, and he sent it along. But, says the OLR and the referee, he didn't explain the significance of it. He didn't explain the means by which it might be used by the defense. That is not a rule, I think, as suitable to impose on district attorneys in the state of Wisconsin, that you need to not only send exculpatory information, but explain to the defense why it's significant and how it might be used. That's just wrong-minded. This is unfortunate that there wasn't a better understanding. The OLR took the position during motion hearings, motion argument in this case. Mr. Zaff could have called. He could have called and explained things to the defense counsel. He could have conducted his own investigation. Well, that's defense counsel's job. I mean, if they didn't understand what was in that 1111 report, they had the duty to follow up, not Mr. Zaff.
Mr. Herman said that the trial judge's decision that there was no Brady violation in this case was just based only on the ID card and the .22 caliber bullet. So I'm looking at the referee's report. It says that ultimately Attorney Glinsky testified that Judge Bruce Strader, the trial judge in this case, ruled that the entire planting of evidence issue by Officer Bars was not relevant and not exculpatory evidence under Brady. Is that accurate? Did the judge go beyond just a narrow focus on the ID card and the .22 caliber bullet? Did he go as broadly as to say the entire incident does not constitute matter under Brady?
Well, I don't have personal knowledge of what his decision was based upon, but I would surmise that he did. I mean, it was the subject of motions by Attorney Glinsky, that there's been gross government misconduct here, and I presume that contemplated the totality of the conduct, and afforded perhaps an opportunity to argue for jury nullification that if this one police officer was behaved badly, maybe everybody should be disbelieved, including the cousin and the co-defendants who testified against Mr. Brantley. So I don't know, I guess is the short answer to your question, but I presume it did contemplate all of what was on the table at that time.
And at least the referee thought so, right? I mean, that was in his report, that is what the trial judge did.
I don't really editorialize on your interpretation. And incidentally, Bars was not referred for a felony prosecution. He was referred for investigation by the Milwaukee District Attorney's Office only long after this revelation to the trial court on the fifth day of trial in the Brantley case. On that fifth day of trial, he didn't know there was a felony committed. He hadn't heard the word planted. He hadn't formed a decision that there was gross misconduct. He knew only what Mr. Glinsky knew or should have known, and what Mr. Rose knew or should have known, and that was that an ID was mishandled.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We will adjourn, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:00. We are adjourned.